Well, this is like a dream come true being here tonight amongst people who are all union members and are also against the war, the impending war. I was a staff sergeant in the U.S. Air Force. I served from 1966 to 1970. I spent a year in Vietnam in 1968, and I spent a year after that in Thailand in 1969 and returned to the United States in 1970. And I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War while I was still a staff sergeant. That didn't last too long. And still active in the military. I really appreciate being here tonight. It's an honor to address a group of people in a union hall sponsored by what is a very progressive Teamster local. And it's like I said earlier, it's like a dream come true for me. I always wanted to see more anti-war stuff going on during the Vietnam War and all the successive U.S. Invasions or incursions abroad. And this is something that is in itself is a very historic occasion. I come from a family of people who have been in the U.S. military since the Revolutionary War. And probably the Vietnam War was when that all ended. As far as I know, nobody in either branch of my family has went into the military after that particular war. And very pleased about that. Military, as it's comprised today, is very different from the military that I was in. It was fueled by a draft first, which was a draft done by the quota system, and then later on by the lottery. That military had its similarities in that the majority of the people doing the majority of the dirty work who are suffering the casualties and who are being injured are the children of the working class, and they're also the children of poorest elements of this society. The military has and always has been a microcosm of our society. Unfortunately, it focuses the worst elements of our society and, in essence, is a sewer, open sewer that runs through our society. It embodies and is fueled by racism, sexism, homophobia. It encourages excessive use of drugs and of alcohol. And this is a place we don't want to send our friends and our children to. It's the most dangerous job in the world. There's no OSHA overlooking what goes on. There's no EPA. In fact, there's not really any justice. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is neither uniform nor just. There's no appeal in the courts. Once something's happened to you in the military, it goes on and on. There are people who are in Fort Leavenworth from the Vietnam War for fragging officers and a variety of other things, and they'll spend their lives in those military prisons. There's no appeal process. Once you're in, and once you're out, you're out. We used to say spending your time in the military was like being a living beverage bottle. Once they were finished with you, they just tossed you out, no deposit, no return. There's a lot of discussion about veterans' benefits. Veterans' benefits have always been given out with an eyedropper and taken away with a steam shovel. Veterans' benefits are, in essence, a bone that are thrown to veterans perhaps to appease them. Every year they get slimmer and slimmer, and it has nothing to do with a Republican or a Democratic government. Year after year, administration after administration, those benefits are shredded and cut to nothing. The benefits that were given World War II veterans would be a substantial way of life now for a lot of veterans, and those benefits are no longer available to them. They make packages. They promise a lot of things. I think the program for going to college coming out of the military whatever the plan is right now, is about as substantial as the plan that UPS offers. In fact, UPS's may be more liberal. They place so many restrictions and so many things on them that it's almost impossible to follow the routine and maximize your benefits. But those benefits are not enough to pay you, obviously, to go to Harvard or go to MIT. Those benefits will put you in the community colleges where you would have went anyway if you hadn't gone in the military. The recruiters border upon pathological in terms of their ability to be honest with the people they're recruiting into the military. They'll lie to you when they don't even have to. They'll tell your parents, your brothers and sisters, anything that they think they want to hear in order to get you to join the military. Even if you sign the papers and decide that you don't want to be in, of course you can get out, but don't trust them to tell you that. I'm told, well, it's a lot better now. Person goes in the military, if they're not fit, they get rid of them right away. And I say, well, isn't that great? They leave the military with a piece of paper that says they weren't fit to serve and they have no useful place in society. And that's something that they carry with them the rest of their lives. From the Vietnam era alone, 375,000 men and women received a variety of discharges, all coded less than honorable, for a variety of things, all given administratively, either by their former commander when they left theaters such as Vietnam or Europe or something and returned to the United States, or upon discharge. There was no hearing, there was no trial, there was no review. They were just given this bad paper and turned loose on the street. I had an honorable discharge and had a very difficult time finding work. I can imagine, and I do know for a fact, how difficult it is for people who were given those bad papers. And that is still with us. It's still with us today. The secret codes that they put on the paperwork that's available to all the major corporations are still on the paperwork today. They've done a lot of backsliding. You're still eligible to be a conscientious objector without being religious. But that information is slim, and all the categories are substantially less today than when they were. It was just wonderful that a member of the Democratic Party stepped up and thought it'd be a good idea to counter the war with saying maybe we should have a draft. Yes, William Rangel, probably a Democratic Leadership Committee person, I don't know. I don't follow him that closely. The draft probably won't come back. They have an economic draft. The military is looked upon as one of the few ways out of the inner city, one of the few ways out of Appalachia, one of the few ways out of Wyoming, out of West Virginia. You look at your states with the decreasing population and the lowest mean incomes, and that's where you'll see the highest number of people joining the military from. It's looked upon as an alternative to nothing. And frankly, it's very difficult to tell a young man or a young woman who face no life, no probability of life, and a very difficult road to hoe that they shouldn't go into military. It's very hard. The best you can do is give them all the advice. We don't call it counter-recruiting. The high schools and the colleges don't like to hear counter anything, so we call it pre-enlistment counseling. We tell them what they can expect in the military, try to give them all the literature we can, give them the stuff that's available from the National Lawyers Guild, the stuff that's still available from Center for Conscientious Objectors out of Philadelphia, some of our own material, and we try to lend them our experience in terms of what they're going to meet in the military. Try to give them another side, obviously, that the recruiters didn't, And if the recruiters bought him a Pepsi, we'll buy him a beer. You know, whatever works. There are children. There are brothers and sisters. We really, really have to look out for them. We have to spend a lot of time talking to them. The best thing that can be done is a relative or a friend of the family who was in the military who can give them some perspective. Do whatever we can. And a lot of times, some of these young people will come forward after programs and say, I guess I won't be going in the military. But they don't need a draft. They've worked this National Guard and Reserve thing now. This strategy came into play in the late 1980s as a way to augment the military and also to lure people in. The Reserves and the National Guard offer the same sort of coded benefits that the regular military does, and with the opportunity to stay home. Of course, we see a lot of people in the Reserves and National Guard leaving home now. The Reserves and National Guard during the Vietnam War were a haven for people who did not want to go overseas but felt that they had to go into military and a lot of working class people took that route because they weren't obviously going to go to college. A lot of young people are not going to college now. It's not economically feasible. And you can turn to any college newspaper and any of the student news services, and they'll show you quite clearly that they're not being encouraged to go to school either. Every roadblock that's conceivable is being thrown in their path with no alternative being given. A lot of your better high schools no longer have any of the technical programs or even the auto shops and that sort of thing. They were the first to go on before even art and music. The important place in our community is to speak at the schools, to speak out in the meetings, to request someone to come in to give a different perspective on the day that the recruiters are in the high school, to ask and request that an independent panel comes in to present another perspective after the recruiters aren't there. Personally, we prefer to do our best work when the recruiters are there, and we'll bring someone from all the different branches and have basically a counter-recruiter for each branch of the military that's represented there. And if the Air Force doesn't show up, we just swing over and help the Navy guy or whatever. You know. But we're in a situation now, I don't have to go long and in-depth about the motives and what drives the ruling class in this country to follow the course that they're following, why they want all the oil that's available to them in Iraq. A lot of these political perspective has been given out over and over again. It's interesting that we're joined in our opposition to the U.S. involvement in Iraq by members of the far right who say we should drop this war on terrorism and forget this war on Iraq and attack China now while we have the opportunity. Unfortunately, these people who we were written off as kooks a number of years ago obviously have the ear of, I won't call them substantial members of this government, but members of this government who recently have had the United States military involved in maneuvers with the government in Taiwan. And I can't see how the Chinese would look at that as in any way, shape or form is anything positive. The very nature of this bunch that are in power now will probably do for the foreign policy and the future of this nation far beyond what the Dulles brothers accomplished in the 1950s, which, by the way, we're still reaping. And it's a sad situation when you look and you see the recycled Cold War people from the Reagan and Bush senior administration. The only thing we're missing is that loose cannon, Ollie North, on deck. And I expect him to come on board any day. This time he won't be a scapegoat or the fall guy because you can do no wrong with this bunch. Any devious, outlandish sort of thing as possible will be done. Part of my duties in Thailand, I was with an intelligence gathering organization in Thailand, the 555th Tactical Reconnaissance, it was called, part of the automated battlefield, but that's another entire two-hour story. We got to know a good number of the Air America guys, and I was surprised that right down to the cadre level, except they'd all been promoted when all the things were going on in Central America, they were under the guise of Air Florida. And it was the same people. And I'm sure that it'll be a number of the same people this time. I don't know what they'll go by. They may just boldly go back to calling themselves Air America again. But the basic thing that they accomplished in Vietnam was the transportation and sales of opium on behalf of the indigenous warlords who supported their cause. In Central America, they appeared to move a lot of cocaine for the Contras. I don't discount the stories that we've heard from the West Coast, and I think a lot of that cocaine probably did end up as crack in our inner cities. Now they have fertile ground in Afghanistan in the Middle East. They'll be moving a lot of opium again. And this time there'll be no checks and balances on them because whatever they want to do, they can do because in this great world of outsourcing work that we have, they're no longer attached to the CIA. They're contractors. And it pretty much sums up that they're going to do whatever they want to do unless people in this country say they can't. And we have much broader support going into this particular era than we had going into the Vietnam War. Once again, the religious people, the Friends Society, those people, they were the first ones on the street again, and you got to give them credit for it. This time, a much broader section of the American people will be in the streets and already are. And I'm so proud that the American Union movement is part of that, and I know we're all going to be working with our locals and our councils and everything and trying to get more involvement and more of the rank and file involved in these sort of things. I'll end it with our two slogans that we feel are the most important slogans for us to carry forth. Slogans, one of which we've been using since 1967 when the organization was founded, and that's decent benefits for all veterans. These people serve in the military, and then they come back. We do a lot of work with the homeless, and one in every three homeless men that you see on the streets in Chicago is a veteran. They're either Vietnam or Vietnam-era veterans, and then we were appalled at the quick turnaround after the Gulf War, how many of these guys literally got off the plane and were homeless immediately. It points out that they had nothing going for them when they went in the military, and the same chances were available to them once they came back. And we want to see an end to that. I know there's a lot of veterans in the room here tonight. Everyone's a veteran. Would you hold up your hand? It's okay. Don't be shy. We all make a mistake once in a while. You know? Veterans have always been a two-edged sword in our society. They're a voice for a voice of reaction, such as the American Legion and later on the VFW, which was formed, by the way, as a progressive alternative to the American Legion. The American Legion, never a friend of unions. In a lot of places where I come from in West Virginia, people wouldn't join the American Legion. They were strikebreakers and vigilantes and Ku Klux Klan, one and the same. And you'll have a lot of people sitting on stools drinking in their establishments that aren't like that, but that's the ideology of that organization, and that's not going to change. Veterans have to become a progressive voice. Veterans always have been a progressive voice. Working class veterans comprised the movement during the Depression that marched on Washington, and they didn't just demand for themselves, they demanded for the entire class that people be given decent benefits, housing, food, the basic things that are guaranteed as human beings. The back home movement after World War II, the veterans anti-war movement during and after the Vietnam War, these are all legacies of veterans and the working class, and they're something that we should be proud of and something that we should continue to support. So we say decent benefits for all veterans and no blood for oil.